KaiserNetwork.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our panelists for Energy Poverty. Executive Director, Fundación Solar, Ivan Azurdia Bravo. Chairman, Development Alternatives, Dr. Ashok Khosla. Founder, Green Belt Movement, Professor Wangari Maathai. And please welcome back our moderator, John Podesta.
Well, if we could quiet down a little bit, and we have a wonderful panel this afternoon. We began by exploring those opportunities that I talked about at the very beginning of the last panel that seemed so exciting, but I think we got to turn our attention and reflection now again on the 2 billion people who live on less than $2 a day and what it means to live without access to modern forms of energy. And I'm excited to be sitting next to Wangari Maathai, who started the Green Belt Movement, an empowerment movement. And I would ask you to either take your discussions into the hallway or, more appropriately, calm down and quiet down. Let me begin, Wangari, with you and ask a question. You created that movement of creating a virtuous cycle of planting trees with women in villages, and it created that cycle of virtue. There's also a cycle of destruction that goes on when people search for energy, when they're out and they're going after and trees, deforestation. And I wonder whether you can talk about just what it's like for people to try to go search for energy sources in the poorest villages and amongst the poorest people.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and I'm really privileged to be here and to have listened. I have sat in this hall throughout since yesterday, and I have learned so much. And one thing I noticed is the fact that we are not really talking very much about the energy that a lot of the poor people use, and that's the biomass, and specifically wood fuel. And that, of course, has a double edge, because to a certain extent, these people need energy like all of us, and they use that form of energy, which is also at the same time very important for sustainability of the environment. So as they cut the trees, as they use dung, or as they use agricultural waste, they are in a way undermining their livelihoods. And so what we have been trying to do is to break the cycle of poverty in which this kind of thing puts them in. But I can tell you that I am also a member of parliament, and the constituency that I represent, when I go to the people and they are asking me for things to do, one of the things that they really ask for is energy. And they are not asking for firewood, because they are already planting trees. They are asking for electricity. And much of the electricity that we have comes from, some of it is geothermal, some of it is hydro, and some of it is from oil. Now, as for the one that comes from hydro, which of course is the form of energy we are talking about here, is dependent on whether you will protect your forests and whether you are able to capture rain and have rivers flowing. So one of the activities that the Green Belt Movement is involved in is protecting the mountainous forests, which are very, very important for our rainfall patterns and for the rivers to flow so that our dams can remain full and be able to produce that hydro energy. So I am really very, very happy, and I want to commend you very, very strongly, because you're being proactive. You are responding to what I heard President Bush say the other day, that America is addicted to oil. And what I have seen here is a genuine and very passionate effort to get out of that addiction, which is really wonderful. I just wish the other part of the world could be as awake to the fact that we have to move to cleaner energies.
Thank you very much. Ashok, in your work with the development alternatives groups, you talk about bringing the idea of sustainable livelihoods to a large scale. And could you just talk about what stands in the way of the rapid deployment of renewables, and how do you bring renewables to a large scale?
Well, I think that's begging the question. Renewables are a central and an important part of the solution, but it's actually energy services that people need. They're not really, nobody looks at how many kilowatts or calories they need. They basically need energy for a variety of purposes,
right?
For pumping water, for lighting, for heating, for cooking, whatever else. Now, if you could provide those services in different ways, sometimes you could use renewables, most of the time you can, it's good. If you're not going to provide those services, then it's tough. Our experience is that most renewables are by their nature local, whether it's the sun or the wind or the biomass. Therefore, you need decentralized systems. Therefore, you need technologies that are very different from the ones that have been invented in the West, because they were never designed to be decentralized. Most Western energy delivery systems are very centralized, either through the grid for electricity or through transportation systems, which are very, very large scale. And so the kinds of approaches needed need different technical solutions. They also need different financial solutions. They need very different institutional solutions. So we basically have a lot of hurdles, a lot of barriers to expansion in a variety of areas. My own experience is that the biggest barrier is non-systemic thinking. It is the barrier that you're going to, we think in silos, in compartments, in ways that the rest of our world doesn't work, actually. And therefore, we think energy. How do we deliver renewable energy? I think that's the wrong question for the following reason. But if you do that, then you miss out on the possibilities of real, genuine solutions. I'll give you one example. I run a company called Desi Power, Decentralized Energy Systems India Limited, which makes power stations in villages based on biomass, gasification, or wind or solar. And like any infrastructure, whether it's roads or bridges or power stations, the cost, unit cost of delivering a service, energy, depends on the plant load factor, on the capacity utilization. You use 30% or 40% of your plant, the cost is going to be 10 rupees a kilowatt hour. If you use 60%, it's going to be 3 rupees. It's a very sharp curve, and it's true of all infrastructure. Now, energy people come and say, well, our job is to deliver electricity or energy, without looking at the fact that if you're going to do that at an affordable price, you've got to also use it. You've got to also have downstream applications. Because if you try to sell it at 10 rupees, nobody will buy it, and you'll never take off. So essentially, the problem is non-systems thinking. It's give them electricity. And when you do that, you basically make it virtually impossible to get the economics right. You have to look at energy as a part of a bigger economic system, which is to create both jobs, livelihoods, and basic needs products. Thanks.
Ivana, I'd like you to maybe just pick right up on that. Yeah, you install energy systems in rural places. What's been your experience? What are the challenges of integrating traditional knowledge in those communities with new technologies? You install a lot of solar, geothermal, et cetera. And just tell us a little bit about your experience in doing that.
Yeah, thank you. First of all, keep in mind that whatever I'm going to say has one obsession in focus: to create jobs where people live. So renewable energy projects that we do is an excuse to catalyze economic growth where people are living. You keep that in mind, we're not talking about energy, but an input to rural development. Energy is but a means to accomplish other economic, environmental, or social ends. So that's really the obsession. How do we create jobs where people live, where there is no roads, no health clinics, no bridges, no schooling, and so on and so forth. There are isolated Mayan communities living in southern Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador. How do we reach people who are out of the market? So the first thing that you do is to find what is the competitive edge of these people. What are these people doing in order to survive without any government presence whatsoever? So you identify something that they're doing right now that has some tradable capabilities. Coffee, might be organic coffee, or the potentiality to be organic coffee. Cardamom, or the potential of precious good woods to be certified, that can be certified. So once you see, okay, technology for what purpose, what productive uses application, then you start saying, okay, what are the technological options that we have to blend in? But then the question goes, as you go to these communities that are isolated with no government intervention whatsoever, they don't speak Spanish, they speak their ancient Mayan languages, but they are surviving there and they are living pretty happily. And you come with these civilizators, you know, we know better, we the engineers, the PhDs, we're going to solve your problems because you're poor. But poverty is not only measured in terms of bucks, in terms of dollars. There are very miserable rich people and very happy poor people in terms of bucks. So what makes this community go around without any government intervention? Then you know there is knowledge there. There is very ancient knowledge on water management, in forest management, in biodiversity, in the way they look at the clouds and read the weather patterns and so on and so forth. So you start rescuing this traditional Mayan knowledge and scaling up their potentials, as well as you scale down high-tech options to create a syncretism of technologies, a blending of technologies, something that is not quite there. Because we in the West are not listening. We have a very good will, the will to power. Nietzsche talked about that a lot. So we change the world and we're going to make changes and we commit, but we don't listen. We don't listen to those that we are trying to be helping. So the first thing is to really try to find what are the needs and try these people, these human beings as citizens, people with rights. You have the right to have water and electricity and these services. You're not a victim that needs to be subsidized and needs to be cared because we know better and you don't know anything. I think that the first thing in implementing this thing is not only having a more humble approach, but also to be able to listen and to learn from the people that you're going to try to serve.
Thank you. Wangari, you said that one of the things you're asked the most in your role in government is how do we get energy out to the villages, to people. And I wonder what strategies right now you're using to try to implement that. Are there any lessons from the Greenbelt movement in terms of empowering individuals to provide energy that are applicable in this context?
Well, the majority of the people in the rural areas definitely still use wood, as I said, or charcoal, especially a large number of poor in the cities, and this is very destructive to the environment. But the government does have a program to take electricity to the rural populations. But as we speak, it takes about $600 per household to bring lighting, not even electricity to use for other utilities, but at least to light their houses. In my own constituency, if you have $600, you can bring electricity to your house today. But if you are dealing with people who make less than a dollar a day, now you know how many people will be able to bring that electricity to the house. So electricity is still largely inaccessible to a large number of people. So for us, it is still a big struggle to provide that energy. And the question is still not, is it clean? It's just, is it energy? For the other side, because we are concerned very much about the environment, we are constantly trying to encourage the government to ensure that even as you know, we have a very strange situation where to burn charcoal in Kenya is not illegal. To have charcoal in your house and to use it, it is not illegal. But if you are caught in the forest cutting trees and turning them into charcoal, it is illegal. So it's a contradiction that partly recognizes that people will use charcoal no matter what. So we are constantly trying to find a balance between allowing people to use this low energy and at the same time protecting the environment. I should mention, especially for people who are interested in carbon credit, that one of the ways in which we are trying to provide financial resources for this campaign is to work with companies through the World Bank who wants to reduce their carbon emissions and give resources to the World Bank. So in fact, we have a pilot project at the moment where we are trying to plant trees with these women. So we pay them money for producing trees, for planting them in mountains that need rehabilitation. And this in turn can help them to get electricity into their houses and cut the need for cutting down trees. So as Ashoka says, and also my colleague from Latin America, I think that what is important for all of us who work at the grassroots level is the realization that you are dealing with an integrated approach to development. But where we recognize that without energy, especially electricity or other forms of energy that you don't get directly from the environment, you are caught, people are caught in a vicious cycle. So breaking this cycle is extremely important, which is what we are trying to do. Now, if we can find partners who are willing to help us plant trees, then we can do two things. We can fix the carbon, so we create these huge carbon sinks, and we provide the resources, and without those resources, they can diversify their energy so that they get away from direct biomass.
Thank you. Ashok, in trying to move the system along, to try to get the energy out to people that Wangari was just talking about, what's the single thing we need to do if there's one? What's the top of your list? I'm sure there's 100 things to do. What's at the top of your list?
At the very top of my list would be an argument to persuade those who make decisions on our behalf. Those could be people in our own countries, the political leaders in our own countries. Could be the people who run the international agencies. It could be the leaders of other developed countries. An argument that would persuade them that people in the South, people in poor countries, need to solve the problem very rapidly. The argument goes like this. Al Gore has shown us how immediate the problems of climate change are. But in most of our analyses, I think we tend to look at, and quite rightly, the next 50 years or so as being the time horizon during which major changes are likely to take place unless we do something about it. Now, if you look at the year 2055 or 56, 50 years from now, it's hard to imagine a world where unfairness continues in the level at which it is today. It would be very difficult to persuade a world in the year 2050 that some people can continue to use 50 times as much energy as other people in the world. It seems to me that if you accept that, that it will be difficult to sustain a world in which the level of unfairness continues like ours today, then it will be unacceptable for us to argue that somebody in a poor country should be forced to have is that better?
Yeah.
Forced to use less kind of materials, resources, energy, or whatever than people in other parts. Now, I plotted on a curve, on a chart, fertility, the size of families, against the use of per capita energy in each country. The data is available. It's from the World Bank or UNDP or whatever else. And I got a dramatically clean curve with a correlation of 0.96, which is phenomenal. Mm. In other words, if I plot energy use per capita this way and how many babies you're going to end up with this way, it's like that. The less the energy, the more the babies. If you extrapolate what will be the numbers of people in the year 2055, if you have continued to have fertility rates that exist today in the poor countries, you're going to end up with 2.5 billion more people than you do if you bring them about to this level. I think that's a powerful argument that it's in the interest of the rich, it's the interest of the powerful to redistribute energy use today in order for us to be sure that the demographic transition takes place soon. Because basically, it's the demographic transition that's going to save overall the amount of carbon emissions we're going to put in to the atmosphere. If you've got 9 billion people, the amount of carbon emissions is going to be dramatically more than if you've got 6.5 billion people. And that's the difference between what happens if you redistribute the amount of energy. So I believe there's a strong case, purely in terms of a 50-year time horizon and calculating how much carbon emission there will be in the world, provided everybody has equal access to energy, that we should be now providing much higher levels of energy, but at least energy services, not necessarily wasteful energy, to the poor today. So it's in the interest of virtually everybody who's actually at the moment monopolizing energy, the rich in our countries in the south as much as the rich in the north, to make sure that the very poorest get a lot more energy now in order for us to have the energy space later on. Thanks.
And have you seen any recent changes in attitude on that point, or do you think we're basically stuck?
We're stuck. I'm not sure that I found very many. I wouldn't say I found very many people who argue against my argument, my thesis. I would say that nobody's willing to make the changes needed in order for you to say, I'm using 9 tons of coal equivalent today. If I give 1 ton coal equivalent to somebody else, chances of my children living in a world that's a lot easier and better for everyone are much higher. I'm not sure anybody's going to do that.
Yvonne, you're out there in the field. You're putting projects in. What's exciting you these days? We've painted to some extent a bleak picture. What's exciting on your front?
This year, I mean, a sabbatical year after I'm being dedicating my 25 years of professional life to work in renewable energy. For me, it's kind of very good news to be here, you know, with I think that if the elites of our countries and the elite of the world make a change in their minds and their souls, we're going to change the planet. It is about individual commitments. And this is really exciting to be here. And today we're celebrating also the equinox. There are ceremonies all over the Mayan world in the sacred temples of Tikal and so on. And also is the World Day dedicated for peace. So it's a good vibration, the one that we're living. And in the sabbatical year that I'm doing is I'm doing research on Mayan science and technology with the idea that the next 25 years of my work cannot be only trying to bring Western high tech to rural communities, but also to bring that knowledge, because our problem is not going to be climate change per se. That's a problem created in the north. Our problem is the vulnerability to the climate variability. I mean, El Niño, La Niña, hurricanes, storms, and so on and so forth. We suffer for the problem created by the north. So we believe, and I think, and I have this is a hinge, this is murder, because it's a gut feeling, that if we rescue this cosmovision, this cyclical way of mimicking the cyclical patterns of Mother Earth into high-tech options, we're going to have better chances. I mean, it's like having a forest. If I plant huge amounts of land with one single species of tree, chances are they are going to get caught in a plague or fire or something like that. But if I have diversity, if I have different trees, some of them might make it down the road. And so this is about having a broader options of technologies. I think that the ingenuity of the North has is tremendous. I mean, the planes, the internet, it's no doubt about it. It will be rubbish, nonsense to talk about or put in question that technological effort and contribution to human progress. But there are other ways to relate to nature that can incorporate the cyclical patterns of life, the cyclical way of renewing and recycling and so on and so forth. And I think the metaphysical thinking of the West that is very linear, logical frameworks, milestones, deliverables, budgets, allocations, so on and so on, beginning and end, linear. If we start thinking that things can be recreated, that things can go around, that there is a chance of renewal, then our time is different. For the Mayans, for example, time is not a linear thing. It's not a thing. It's like a flower, like a human being. It lives. It's alive. So when you think time as something alive, it's a different mind setting. So what I'm trying to do right now is to bridge, redundantly, I mean, to create a communication between two cultures, one that it's powerful and moving forward, and that's what is very backward and underdeveloped. So the possibilities and the chances are that we're going to learn from each other, that we can create something that it's new, that we have overlooked over the ages and this rush for getting a better life, and be more quiet and more contemplative of things that are around us. I mean, Martin Heidegger says that the things that are near to us are the things that are more away from us. We don't think about this technological mediation that what we have created. We think that technology is to serve humankind, but maybe it is the other way around. Right now, there is machine that produces machines without the presence of human beings. Is that we're controlling technology or technology is controlling us? Well, those are philosophical questions, but the practical thing is that how do you get into solving the problems of the people? We have a lot of young people. 70% of the population in Central America has less than 17 years old. Either we create jobs over there, being creative, being innovative about the things that are already there that can be improved, plus making more affordable what it's already high-tech, frontier technology. Or else we're going to have problems on migration, and we're going to have a lot of violence. The history of Central America and Mexico is a history of revolutions. If the Western world is entangled with these problems in the Far East and the Middle East, and they continue to be like that, we cannot afford to have other political bills drawn by poverty next door or in the backyard, as you some of Americans call our territories. That will be very dangerous. So the investment right now, the investment should be in creating jobs over there in a way that open markets to products that are organic, that are fair trade, that are based in biodiversity, because that's the only competitive edge. We're not going to get to make computers or to make solar panels. That's impossible. We can offer basically the dessert of the developed world: sugar, bananas, coffee. How do we pre-create better sugar and banana and coffees? How do we make it more healthy? But the balance of trade is going to be very difficult. How many bananas, containers of banana, of coffee, do we have to export in order to bring high-tech options? The gap is getting every time bigger. So we have to find ways that our products are competitive and appealing to a more educated market, whether they want to organic coffee, organic products, natural fibers, and so on and so forth. In this way, we're going to be creating a market pool. We're going to be creating jobs over there, but also we're going to be opening options for new technical milieu.
Well, that was terrific. But I'm tempted to give Wangari just a minute or two, maybe to respond to Yvonne and say and whether that related to your experience in terms of trying to empower people, what he was suggesting, which is really a different way of thinking about trying to bring technology to bear in a way that's more appropriate to the way people want to use it. Is that where we got to start, which is to ask what they want to use the technology for?
Well, I guess those of us who work at the grassroots and who are working with the poor people in the developing countries have the frustrations that we know where the potentials are. For example, if you ask me all the technologies that we have been talking about here, yes, it can be brought there. But I also know that that the people there do not have the capacity to absorb these technologies on their own, that they, you would have to come and, for example, extract the different types of energies, convert them, distribute them, and literally sell everything to them, because you have the technology and they have the resources, but they don't have the knowledge and the skills. But if they're making less than a dollar a day, you're not going to do any business with them. You have the option of either exploiting them, just use the resources and walk away with the profits, or you can decide that you want to help them. But for them to be helpable, they need, with their leaders, to put themselves in a position where they can take advantage of the goodwill that I know is there. I sense a lot of goodwill wherever I go, and I know that a lot of people who have come to this Clinton Global Initiative are largely people of goodwill, and they wish they could go there and help. And I know that there are a lot of people here who are thinking, how can I go to Africa and help? But I don't want to talk too long, but I want to say that whatever we do to go out there and help the poor people, the bottom line is you'll never help the poor people. You have got to help them to help themselves. You cannot go there and do things for them. You'd have to work with them to help themselves. But to do so, you need their leadership. That is why some of us don't just go there and say plant trees or grow food or produce simple energies. We go and we say, let us also improve governance so that you have an enabling environment with which you can work and improve the quality of life. But I know that some of you are urging to go there and help. My word is, work with the people who are there, those of us who have been struggling, to see if we can help not only improve the economy, not only improve the social situation, but also improve the political situation. Because for Africa, at least, Africa is not a poor continent. It's the African people who are poor. And the resources are there, but they are quite often extracted and removed from the continent, and the people are left poor. So to help them is not to go there and do things for them. It's to help them help themselves, acquire knowledge and skills so that they can utilize the resources they have.
Okay, it is time for you to have a discussion, and then we're gonna take a little bit of a break, and then we're going to come back and we're going to talk about some of the solutions that Wangari just talked about. Thank you.
Let's thank the panel for this first round. Some terrific insights. Great. Okay, the two questions for this round, and obviously we'll be consolidating tables, are how can I help reduce energy poverty? This may be one of the most difficult questions we've faced today. And what are the most important steps for bringing clean energy services to the poor around the world? So again, let me suggest that we actually collapse tables. And facilitators who don't end up with a table in this round, please be sure to, you can join a conversation if you'd like, and please be sure to be back here at 5:30. Angelo and Yellow, thank you. So please welcome His Eminence. And we would like to make a suggestion for everyone to move forward, and we can make this final conversation a quite intimate conversation between the panelists and all of you who are here. So if you would just quickly move forward, and you don't have to stay with your table mates, just fill in the seats here in the front part of the room. Also, I want to remind anyone who needs it, there is simultaneous translation. The headsets are on your table. One will be English and two will be Spanish. In Portuguese. Okay. Thank you. All right.
My turn?
Yep.
Thank you. Well, we welcome Cardinal Agnello and His Eminence celebrated Mass for 10,000 people in France this morning, and then his plane was late. So I think he's more reliable than the airline industry. But we're going to – he was supposed to be on our panel this morning, so we're going to begin this session in a slightly different way and let the Cardinal begin by giving a few comments. We've heard a lot about the effect of ethanol in Brazil and what it's done for job creation, 1 million jobs created there in the ethanol industry and poverty. And we wanted to ask him first to just give his reflections on what's happening in Brazil on this energy question.
Boa tarde a todos. Eu diria que sobre as experiências já vividas de novas energias para uso, nós tivemos o emprego do álcool como alternativa para a gasolina. E foi uma experiência notável, mas ao início o preço era bom, hoje não é tão diferente o preço do álcool e da gasolina. Por outro lado, nós temos uma experiência hoje que se faz com o óleo de mamona para ser empregado com o diesel. Ainda não está comercializado bastante, mas parece que tem já positiva a experiência. Portanto, para o problema da pobreza, da miséria, por enquanto, nós não temos uma repercussão maior. Nos centros urbanos, nós temos a eletricidade, que está presente mesmo nas favelas. Sobretudo, nas favelas, nós temos muito uso da televisão. Os mais pobres podem passar até dificuldades para comer, mas não podem perder a televisão. Mas quanto a outras experiências de energias novas, estão várias universidades já começaram, especialmente no estado de São Paulo, a estudar novas fontes de energia. E, naturalmente, há uma aprovação por parte do governo, mas não temos, assim, nenhum dado para poder trazer aqui. Naturalmente, eu gostaria de falar também sobre quanto às exigências humanas e hoje a sociedade como está. E os também os mais pobres Eles querem ser felizes. Eles querem ter acesso aos bens
e serviços que a ciência e a tecnologia have been providing, but this is not enough to create a society where everyone's rights are respected. And I think that the bigger picture here is that of the human rights, which are not the same, and some are not in the interest of everyone. When we talk about research and of assets which technology may offer, not all will have access to such progress. Thus, I would like to reflect a little bit more later on.
Thank you, Your Eminence. We're going to get back to the questions that have come from the audience. And I want to begin by asking Ashoka a question, which is, we talked in the last panel about a lot of liquidity in the market, a lot of deal flow, money flowing into energy projects. And the question is, are they flowing into these energy projects that are really affecting the poorest people on the planet, and are development agencies willing to consider climate change issues when they're funding projects that might help, again, in these poorest communities?
John, my own experience is there's very little money. I mean,
little money.
Yeah, I see other people saying we get a lot of money for energy projects, building big power stations and dams and a lot of other things, but frankly, I've worked in this area for 20 years, and I'm constantly scrounging around for pennies, and I can't even get those. We have very, very interesting business models. We've got decentralized systems. We've got energy technologies that work and have been proved. And in some cases, they need scaling up before they can be proved because of the economies of scale, whatever that means. The fact is that transaction costs on the one hand and delivery systems on the other hand need to be done on a certain minimum scale. And I don't see this money. We've had money from governments like the Dutch government for kind of climate change funds. Before CDM, there was AIJ. So we've got JI money, AIJ money, CDM money. On pilot scale basis to put up one little 100 kilowatt power station here or four power stations there for villages. But frankly, it's been hard work, and I haven't seen the color of this money myself.
And are there changes in policy that could change that you would recommend?
See, the first policy change is that in all our countries, north, south, east, west, America, India, conventional energy is hugely subsidized. It's subsidized by governments, and it's subsidized by nature. Frankly, it's virtually impossible for any new technology to compete with those subsidized prices. So grid electricity is delivered at, let us say, X cents per kilowatt hour. If you develop a technology that doesn't match that or less, it's not going to go, because clearly nobody's going to pay more than they have to. Subsidies, removal of subsidies from conventional energy, and maybe some degree of temporary subsidies for the capital investment required for the new ones, the renewable ones, would make a huge difference. Temporary subsidies sometimes are needed because basically the barriers to entry are just too huge to get going. Apart from that, the other thing is, as I said earlier, you have to think systems. Plonking a power station in a community, a village community, is just suicide from the point of view of economics. You've got to do it in such a way that it makes money. And that you can only do, as I said earlier, by putting it in as a part of an industrial system, so that from day one, that power station is actually supplying electricity or whatever at a reasonable cost. So there are lots of other things you need to do. But the first thing to do is simply remove the huge subsidies that we have, preventing anything else from coming into being.
Wangari, I'd like to ask you a question about the impact of oil prices. The Cardinal mentioned the fact that the price has gone up again in Brazil, but the impact of oil prices on least developed countries. We've done some work. We were working on this Ethiopia program. Ethiopia spent more on the increase in the price of oil, just the delta in the price of oil since 2002, than the total amount of spent on public health last year. I want to ask this in a more optimistic way, though. Does biofuel development offer an opportunity in East Africa or in other parts of Africa that can, for the non-importing countries, to break the link and provide jobs for people and repeat the success that they've seen in Brazil?
Well, what I know is that at least in Africa, where many countries import oil, they definitely have to sacrifice essential services in order to get oil. And as we all know, it is usually the poor people who get sacrificed by the ruling elites, because the ruling elites will nevertheless have had to have their electricity, and they have to have their cars, and they have to drive them around. So the kind of people we work with are the ones who are often sacrificed in terms of education, in terms of health. And that's why, of course, we get very concerned and keep raising the issues of the debt. And despite all the campaign that we have done, that continues to be an agenda on the table, because many countries just can't pay the debts and at the same time provide the essential services that you need for the poor people. Options such as the clean development mechanism. I think that, as we said earlier, for me anyway, this is an area where we can partner with people who want to do something about their carbon footprints, and at the same time help poor people take care of their environment. Because I have seen definitely the work we do, poor communities do benefit by taking care of their environment, protecting their soils, planting trees, and although they burn them, it's nothing to compare with the kind of emissions that we find in developing countries. Therefore, when I see the kind of enthusiasm that I have witnessed here at this meeting, then I say, well, those of you who want to get rid of your carbon footprints, we can partner, and communities will benefit because they do plant trees, and the way we do it in the Greenbelt movement, for every tree that will survive, those who planted them get a financial compensation. And if you want to know more about the Greenbelt movement, you could visit us at greenbeltmovement.org so that you see what we do. I am quite sure that we can partner, and until we do so, then we can really demonstrate how poor people can benefit. But I think it's one area where good stories can come, good success stories can come that do good for the environment from your perspective and also do good for the environment and the poor communities in the South.
Thank you. Yvonne, I think this follows right on, which is I think a lot of people were asking the question that was posed in Vice President Gore's comments at lunch, which was how can we help developing countries leapfrog straight to cleaner technologies, bypass the development path of using particularly the dirtiest of the hydrocarbon alternatives. And is that possible, and is that the right strategy?
Yes, I think it's the only strategy. I mean, it's a matter of survival. We cannot afford to follow the path of the United States or other developing countries. We just do not have the resources, financial resources, the person power to undertake these transformations. We need the leapfrog to get to the new technologies immediately, because it's a matter of national security. We are not going to get the petroleum that others are going to be looking for at higher prices. We simply cannot pay for them in a balance of payment situation, number one. So to recognize that, we have to develop a policy that it's not an energy policy. I think that the problem with the engineers and all the people that I know working in the energy sector is that we think about megawatts and transformers, substations, and so on. But energy for what? The know-how is very important, but know why it's even more important. I mean, what do we need this energy for? What is the competitive edge of every country? Every country is going to have different products to offer to the international market. So where, what type of energy, at what price, with what natural resources, and what are the agricultural policies of one country, the poverty reduction strategies of our countries, and so on and so forth. So we cannot design energy policies in a vacuum. We have to do a geopolitical analysis of where the energy flows are moving and the markets are moving, what are the resources that we have, and then what are the competitive edges of our countries in different areas of productivity, tourism, agriculture, forestry, and so on. Every country is going to be different. And then with that, design the energy policy. In Latin America, we have a tragedy because we don't have the difference between policy and politics. La política, it gets complicated because people think that politics is the same as our policy. They are interrelated, correlated. They build upon each other, but different. Policy is the long-term vision of everybody, the poor, the rich, efficiency, equity. Politics as whole, do we share the cost and the benefits? Who compensates the one who are losers? And how do recognize the allocation of resources in the political game among the constituency groups? So the first thing is to try to help us, our governments, in developing sound policies for the agricultural sector, health sector, democracy, and so on and so forth. And then energy comes. It's not an energy policy, the one that we need. For example, the tragedy of the commons, to avoid the destruction of the watersheds that we still have in Central America. Fuel wood and water have zero market value. So the policy should be not to create kilowatts, but to create a way to pay for the environmental services that a given watershed is providing in terms of water and forestry. So how do you do that? Kilowatts, even if they are subsidized and deformed by market inefficiencies, they have a market value. A percentage of those kilowatts delivered plus the clean development mechanism or other niche specialized carbon trading plus a government incentive so we can money, so we can have a pool of money that we can pay the campesinos to say, okay, this is the financial flow that is going to pay for planting trees, because we cannot expect the campesinos to be planting trees and wait for 10 years to take advantage of those plantations. We need to have to create those financial mechanisms, and the kilowatts are something that is tradable. A percentage of that plus a carbon credit plus government funds can create... So, the development of a small hydro systems run of the river, it's not then an energy project. It's a way of adding value to natural resources that otherwise are not going to be there. And ensuring that the energy that it's used by most of the people, 90% of the population in the developing world, even if they have electricity, they consume fuel wood for cooking. So we have to take into account that energy is not electricity or fossil fuel. It has to deal with firewood at the heart of the household. So I will say that leapfrogging is something that we have to do regardless of what the North decides to do. But let me just add one little thing on the CDM. In order for these things to work, I mean, the CDM is a great failure for projects oriented toward equity. The world needs to move in efficiency. I mean, the private sector is aggressive, it's educated, has the means to move around, and the connections and so on and so forth. Those things are happening. But what happened with the equity side of the equation? We need two legs to walk. So if we don't create other forms that reduce the transactional cost of the clean development mechanism to pay for sustainable development, and remember that the Marrakesh and the CDM and the Kyoto Protocol was created not just to fund big private sector projects, it was with the spirit of sustainable development, to help those that are left out of the market sector in a way that can bring a sustainable path into their future. So That is the type of money that philanthropic organizations should be putting their eyes in. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we're going to turn things over to David to give us a summary of the themes, and then I think we'll have maybe time for a few last comments.
Thanks, John. So following a pattern we have seen all day, there was a lot more content provided for the second question than the first question. For the how can I help reduce energy poverty, we got three basic concepts: investing in developing world clean energy projects, a fair amount of private sector investments. Second, contributing donations, contributing to social entrepreneurs. And third set of ideas was around changing the language. Discuss the moral, economic, and security reasons for reducing energy poverty. Don't focus on per capita equity, somebody said. More interest from all of you on what are the most important steps for bringing clean energy services to the poor. A lot of discussion about promoting leapfrog technologies, as Ivan was just talking about. Creating local biomass projects, cleaner burning wood stoves, and following up with local biogas. Foundations should focus on what works on the ground in developing countries. A lot of good ideas around promoting capacity building. Take advantage of robust local leadership, develop social entrepreneurs. Discussions of debt relief, updating development assistance goals to focus on clean energy, and then bundling small energy projects so that they can become attractive to lenders. Lots of very, very interesting ideas. The gems that we liked, somebody said the poor reminded us the poor aren't only in the rural areas, they're in the cities too, something we discussed yesterday. And then solar power is a 93-million-mile extension cord. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Your Eminence, much of the discussion today, especially on this panel, has been on the question of the fact that energy disconnected from a policy of development at the local and village community level in cities, in slums, can't take place. You can't just isolate energy. And I wonder whether you might want to reflect on that and talk about what you see as the development needs for the poorest people in Brazil.
I think that for us in Brazil, we need education. We need health for everyone. Quality education, not just elementary or primary education, that does not continue through the end of training and the educational system. There's school evasion, a great rate of evasion, and teenagers are not well fed, therefore their capacity for studying is highly reduced. Therefore, I think that education is the most important motivation for developing a country. Education for all and quality education for all. It is not enough to have quotas to favor enrollment in universities for poor people, for African Brazilians, as happens in the city of Salvador. In my diocese, there is a great presence of Afro-descendants, and it is not enough to have quotas for these people to enroll in the university. If these people cannot sustain themselves in the university, because they have not been duly prepared. Health is also very important. We need to improve the level of health assistance in an important way. All the rest will be a consequence if there's good education and good health for all. We will advance, especially the poorer people in our society.
I want to ask a question that I asked Yvonne of Ashok and Wangari, which is, what's exciting you these days? What's giving you hope in this arena in terms of developing new energy sources and getting energy out to the people? Ashok, do you want to start?
I think what it boils down to is that the existing technologies, the existing ways of doing things with energy are not adequate, and you're going to need new ones. But the ones that you need in poor societies and communities of third world villages are not ones that are going to be developed in the north. There's no incentive for companies in America or Japan or Europe to develop solutions that are not going to make them huge amounts of money. And solutions that you need are going to have to be addressed and developed in the south. And what excites me is that there is a resurgence, whether it's in Africa and or in Brazil or in Latin America, and certainly in my country, of young people who are now taking responsibility for becoming inventors and innovators in this broad area of water, land, and energy. And I've seen a project, for which we don't have time now, in Colombia that creates huge quantities of energy with virtually no investment whatsoever. And I think the whole new science that is needed of regenerating the countryside, which is much more biological systems rather than engineering systems based on physics and mechanical energy, are going to actually be the solutions. And I think that's very exciting.
Wangari, I'm going to give you the last word.
Yeah, thank you very much. I would say that for me, the excitement is the need for awareness. I feel really energized to create awareness within our region for people, both ordinary people and governments, to understand that the change, the global warming is a real thing also for us, and that we are most likely to be the greatest victims of global warming. And I know that that awareness is not there. Whether the signs are coming to us in terms of prolonged drought and failure of rainfall to come, crop failures, famine. And those of you who have been following the East African region recently, we had a prolonged drought that actually caused loss of life of human beings and livestock and wildlife. So, and we also know that the snow on Mount Kenya and on Kilimanjaro has been melting at a rate we have never seen before. So signs are there. But it is very, very important that both our leaders and our people understand that. I'm also very excited to be in a forum like this to see the enthusiasm that is within the civil society and the private sector here in America. And the fact that your government has not yet signed the Kyoto Protocol seems to be rather irrelevant, because so many of you are really very, very proactive, which is wonderful. And I do see an opportunity for us to partner in areas where we can. And for me, instead of being overwhelmed by all the problems, especially that we have down there, I find energy in the fact that there is one thing that is doable even with those poor people, and that is planting trees. So any one of you who is willing to come and dig a hole, come and join us.
With that, I would just like to close by saying that I want you all to remember that second leg of Yvonne's two-legged person, which is that we have to keep our eye on the development side. He was referencing the Clean Development Mechanism, but to try to make sure that as we focus on new energy technologies that become sustainable and low carbon and put us into that solution, we keep our eye on the ball that there are a lot of poor people that Wangari talked about who are going to suffer the most from global warming, and we have to concern ourselves with their development needs as well. Please join me in thanking the entire panel one more time.
And while you're still clapping, another round of applause for David and Amy and Mike, who put this all together. Michael. And frankly, most important, a round of applause to all of you for being here and having this commitment for these 3 days. I have to make one other quick announcement, which is why I'm up here. Facilitators, if you would just take a minute and enter into your computers your top line recommendations to CGI, and then gather very quickly up here around a couple of tables, because we want to do a little debrief and thank you. And theme team members, if you'd also migrate up here. Facilitators, you can take any computer anywhere close around. You don't have to go back to your table. Thank you.